Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Investing can feel intimidating and people don't know where to start. And many think you need a lot of money to invest. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing for your future. You do not need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can get started with just your spare change. Acorns recommends an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you. For me, investing often gets put off because it doesn't seem urgent and busy lives mean little time to research and manage investments. But you can head to acorns.com/hiddentruecrime or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Paid non-client endorsement compensation provided incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorn Advisors LLC and SEC registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/hiddentruecrime.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com.
Hello, Hidden Gems. It's Lauren and John. Surprise. I think you guys were expecting us. I have my reporter mic. This is my travel set. So I can say, John, back to you, like I used to in the back in the days when I was working in TV. But I'm so glad to be home with my husband this Memorial Day weekend, despite us being in separate rooms. But so hence my travel mic. And we have an important show, I think, for you today, because what happened Thursday in court was really important. And John is going to share his thoughts and things that we've discussed together. You're also going to discuss some other things that happened this week. We're sort of going to put some pieces of the week together. This week in the Chad Daybell case has been defense. So unlike Lori Vallow's trial last year at this time, there were defense witnesses called for Chad Daybell's trial. And his attorney, John Pryor, called those witnesses this week. They included Emma Daybell Murray and Garth Daybell, Chad and Tammy Daybell's children. And then rebuttal started on Thursday with the prosecution. Whoa, what a week. So
just to clarify, when you say you're in another room, you mean you're in another office for the show.
Yeah, I'm not pulling. Yes, nothing wrong with couples that sleep apart. I know that's a thing to have your own bedroom, but that is not what we do. Right. I do not mean we share a master bedroom and we are in our separate. I don't know if you'd call mine an office. I'm sitting in a little corner of a guest room. But yes, separate rooms so that we can do the split screen and you're in your office.
Right. Because the last time you said that, we got all kinds of questions. So I just want to clarify before we get those questions again.
Right. Couple to each their own. John and I share a master bedroom. I know some couples are like, hey, separate beds.
We're doing the show from separate offices. So yeah.
Yeah.
It actually has some prescience for tonight's show because we'll be talking about Tammy Daybell's death and where she was and whether Chad was with her, right? So in a way, it is relevant because it doesn't seem like Chad was in the same bed with Tammy.
Correct.
When she died, or at least when Garth found her. So yeah, that's something we'll be talking about that's important to the case.
So is this foreshadowing or is this a Freudian slip? Or did I just also do something else and foreshadow a
Freudian slip? No, this is Freudian slips
we're going to talk about. Okay, so I'm foreshadowing some Freudian slips we're also going to talk about.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we'll talk about some important Freudian slips during the trial that I really didn't weigh on too heavily, but I want to talk more about that tonight and what a Freudian slip is and why it's important or could be important on this case. Yes. So
there we go. And with all of this laid out, John, back to you.
The defense called their final witness, who was Dr. Eric Bartolink. Dr. Eric Bartolink is a professor of anthropology. He's a human remains expert, and he was called to essentially talk about Tylee's remains. So I'd be a little remiss if I didn't bring up my favorite expert witness, Dr. Craig Hampikian, who was the last witness on Wednesday. I said that that was like the defense's aha moment for the entire trial, because basically Dr. Hampikian took the stand. And when I say he's my favorite witness, I mean, it looked like he had just come into the courtroom from changing the oil on his truck, like 5 minutes before he strolled in there, because he was super casual. He was laid back, right? He was totally, he looked like, I don't know, it's hard to describe him. We were kind of joking that he's like, you know, the most expertly expert that ever lived. Like, this guy is confident, you know. Pryor was fangirling him. It was amazing. But
expertly expert face. Yes.
So I thought that he was going to be, I thought he was going to be the last witness, just because of the way Pryor was treating him and because of this moment where he essentially said that there's no DNA that can be linked to Chad Daboll in terms of, at least in terms of JJ's remains. I mean, he was sufficiently vague about it to imply that there was no DNA anywhere that would tie Chad Daboll to these crimes. And as I pointed out, that doesn't really matter, because this is a conspiracy to commit murder case. So you don't have to be present. You don't have to have DNA on the crime scene to be convicted of a conspiracy case. But anyway, the reason I'm bringing this up is because I didn't expect another witness to be called. And so here comes Dr. Eric Bartolink, who also, by the way, was super casual. Let's talk about Dr. Bartolink for a moment. He was an interesting expert. You know, I've talked about how sometimes witnesses can backfire for the defense. And I feel like that was largely what happened here. But so Pryor brought him on to essentially say that he believed that Tylee was, her body was burned as a whole. And because her limbs were missing, he thought that perhaps the body had been moved to Chad's property. The implication that I took from that, or I guess the implication that Pryor wants the jury to draw from that, is that presumably Alex Cox or somebody else committed this murder, tried burning the body unsuccessfully, removed the limbs, and then moved the remains to Chad's property, thereby suggesting that Chad not only wasn't involved in the murders or the direct murders, but that Chad was not the one on the property. Alex was the one on the property when the remains were placed. So that's essentially what Pryor, I think, was trying to accomplish. And again, let's get back to this idea that this is a conspiracy to commit murder case. So Chad Daboll does not need to murder anyone here. He does not even need to be on the property. His DNA does not need to be there. For a conspiracy to commit murder case, basically, you just have to have, there has to be an agreement. There has to be an intentional agreement to murder someone. So there has to be a plan or intent to kill someone. So if, you know, in a lot of Lifetime movies, you'll see, you know, people will meet in a park or wherever. They'll meet somewhere somewhat secretive and they'll talk about killing someone. And the plan might even be vague. That is conspiracy to commit murder. And if somebody is murdered from that clandestine meeting in the park, that's still considered first-degree murder. That person can be convicted of first-degree murder for simply planning a murder and talking about a murder in a park, for example. And so I think, you know, there's a little bit of a sleight of hand here with Pryor. He's trying to redirect the focus and suggests that because there's no DNA and there's not a huge amount of physical evidence against Chad, that somehow he should be exonerated or acquitted of murder. And of course, he's neglecting to say that this is a conspiracy case and none of that is really relevant. So like I said then, this is kind of smoke and mirrors, but let's get back to Dr. Bartolink. So he's trying to argue that the body was burned as a whole and therefore it's unlikely it was burned on Chad's property because the limbs were removed and they weren't there. The body was dismembered. This is how this backfires spectacularly to me. On cross-examination, we learn not only that the limbs were dismembered, that they were removed, but we also learn that there's a series of blunt force traumas. There's a jawbone fracture. This was new information to me. There's a jawbone fracture. So the jawbone is fractured in six places from blunt force trauma. The pelvis, the skull, the sternum, and the ribs were all subjected to blunt force trauma. The pelvis, as we know from previous testimony, the pelvis had a number of sharp force defects. There were two fractures to the ribs. And all told, this was a remarkable statistic. This is one of the last things that Dr. Bartling said. He said, there were 18 sharp force defects and 16 blunt force traumas to Tylee's body. If you're trying to picture what happened to Tylee, the reason why this backfires spectacularly is because it's very easy to imagine that Tylee fought back. That Tylee, at some point, Tylee knew what was going to happen. She was maybe attacked, physically attacked. She fights back. Somebody hits her, I would imagine, maybe hits her with an object or with a fist. I don't know, but somebody hits her with sufficient force to break her jaw, to fracture her jaw in six places. Hits her ribs with sufficient force to fracture multiple ribs. Unfortunately for the defense, in my mind, this expert is creating this vivid picture of what happened. And I'm sure, I can't imagine, you know, people tend to be in these scenarios when you present information like this, people tend to be pretty visual. And it's not hard to imagine the jury kind of getting the implications of this, that a broken jaw is not something you're going to get from tripping.
It's heartbreaking. They called it blunt force trauma. They call it what it is.
Right. Yeah. And so, I mean, it's horrible. It's the picture. What Dr. Bartling presented to the jury was, forget about the fact that the body was burned as a whole and maybe moved, was the picture of someone who was attacked violently, subdued, and then murdered, presumably when she was alive. And it's not hard to imagine that the sharp force defects to the pelvis involved something horrific. So the last witness for the defense is actually painting a vivid picture of a gruesome murder that's almost certainly going to help the prosecution in my mind's eye.
It definitely did. There were, I can share with you because I was in the courtroom and it was, oh my gosh, it was a heartbreaking morning. There were tears, including me, mostly after. We are told before court that if we show emotion on our face, that court might not be for us and that we should consider watching from home. I want to keep saying, well, maybe it's not as bad as I think it is when it comes to Tylee, you know, after we hear things. And I think it's just how I personally protect myself. Well, maybe not. And all that witness did on Thursday was solidify every fear I've ever had. And that is what that witness did.
Yeah. And I think that the point that Pryor was trying to get across to the jury was that somehow by moving the body to Chad Dable's property, that Chad Dable didn't participate in that. But again, the issue is not whether he directly participated. And by the way, it's not hard to imagine that he did, but because of the pickaxe, Tylee's DNA on it that's in his garage and the shovel.
But let's also remember that we learned from Melanie Gibb that he took JJ upstairs to discipline him and came back with a scratch on his neck.
Right, exactly. And so the question is whether he knows that out. I mean, let's assume that Pryor is correct. The question is, is there some agreement between Chad and Lori and Alice Cox to plan and carry out this murder, even if the body's moved? I mean, I don't necessarily believe that it was moved, but this particular witness paints a very disturbing picture of what happened to Tylee, and it's one that's not going to help Chad Dable, I'm pretty sure.
And so I can tell you this too. Chad Dable, once again, empty vessel. So here was the entire courtroom just trying to control our emotions. Not Chad Dable. He sat there like a slug. Zero emotion from him as the witness. Like, I almost think he was thinking, yeah, see, there's no proof. Like, it was crazy. He didn't seem to get what was going on. He was the only one that seemed to not get what was going on in that courtroom.
Yeah, and I don't think he understands. I think he certainly understands the charges against him, but I'm not sure he entirely understands this idea that, like I talked about, I made a comparison with the Charles Manson murders, where Manson wasn't present, and essentially the jury convicted Manson because of his ideology. The jury found, or the prosecution argued, that Charles Manson's beliefs, essentially, is his ideology constituted an overt act of conspiracy. And that's what you have here. You have someone with this extreme belief system of dark and light and zombies and dark spirits that's trying to murder people because he's designating them as dark spirits. And people, whether himself or other people, are agreeing to that and carrying it out. And that's a conspiracy to commit murder, whether he's present or not. And that's exactly, you know, that's why Manson was convicted, because it was his belief system that was considered to be the most detrimental element of that particular case. And that was considered to be a clear act of conspiracy. And so a lot of this defense case is just pure subterfuge. It's pure, you know, redirection. It's smoke and mirrors. It's trying to get the jury to focus on elements of the case that aren't that important, that aren't that salient. And so, you know, I guess the question is, did Pryor accomplish that? I don't know. You know, I most juries, I think, are pretty astute. And I think when they get instructions from Judge Boyce, that they'll focus on what they need to. But it was an interesting defense case in the sense that a lot of it was completely irrelevant. Not only was it a miscalculation on Pryor's part, but I mean, it was a bit tone deaf. Right? I don't know how Pryor believed that that would strike a nerve with the jury. I guess Pryor's not processing the emotional component of testimony, and he's thinking only in terms of strategy, and he's thinking only in terms of this as an intellectual puzzle. If you see this as an intellectual puzzle and you argue that the body had to be burned somewhere else and moved, then maybe he thinks he's going to score some points. But there's clearly this lack of emotional intelligence, like not reading the emotional impact of an expert saying that her bone was fractured in 6 places.
Well, let's go further. John Pryor's cross exam was terrible.
Yeah.
John Pryor got up with one question. I don't know if he thought he was being smart or what. So we hear about this blunt force trauma on Tylee, her head, her sternum, her jaw. And John Pryor gets up and essentially confirms it by posing the question, but you're telling me that this blunt force trauma didn't necessarily, there's no proof that it happened at Chad Daybell's property. And all I'm sitting here thinking is, John Pryor knows very well about this blunt force trauma. This is blunt force trauma, and this is his attorney who's been talking to Chad Daybell for years and years. And he just got up as we're like processing the blunt force trauma. He gets up to be like, okay, so, you know, yeah, blunt force trauma confirmed. By the way, though, where did it happen? So I don't think he fully grasped that we were all like, you know, trying to control our emotions in the courtroom while he gets up to thinks that that's going to help. Because that's all I got out of it is, wow, just wow. And I think you're right. John Pryor is looking at this as some sort of like creating doubt and some sort of formula. And he's not taking into account the emotions. And
I think it's one of the critical mistakes that defense attorneys and sometimes prosecutors make as well, is that they see cases as intellectual puzzles and not as storylines that involve a lot of emotions. And I think that, you know, as I talked about before, juries really want to know the most coherent story. And they also, emotions are a big part of that story. So in some ways, the most coherent story that makes sense of the evidence and grabs their emotions in particular is the story they're going to go with. They're actually going to be put off by, if you tell a story that lacks emotions and it's purely intellectual, then it's not going to resonate with a typical jury. You know, and I think that Pryor is clearly seeing this as an intellectual puzzle. In some ways, he thinks he's more clever than the prosecution, and that he's outsmarting them and out-strategizing them. But that's not, again, that's not what juries are really looking at, or that's not what resonates with juries.
The other thing that witness proved to everyone, I think there was some doubt, those severe wounds that you referred to in her pelvis that happened at or near the time of death. We all still wanted to hope that maybe a lot of people even wrote me after saying, no, Lauren, you're wrong. A lot of people wanted to believe that that was maybe part of the fire or just dismembering. But what that witness told us was that no, Tylee was most likely burned whole, which means that these marks that happened at or near the time of death without burn marks had nothing to do with that. I'm sorry to say that, but like, don't underestimate the evil of these crimes. Don't underestimate what that slug sitting there is capable of. And he showed no emotion during this testimony. Zero. As we in the courtroom and the gallery are all processing it with just shattered hearts. Don't underestimate that person in the courtroom and what he's capable of. I just want to say that. And I don't think now that the jury's going to underestimate him either. And that was the power of that defense attorney. And when I say power, or defense witness, but not for the defense. It was a powerful moment for justice and for the prosecution. Thank you, John Pryor, for your contribution to justice.
And let's, if you have it, let's talk about another potential horrible moment for Pryor.
Is that an example of confirmation bias when you take into account all of these other reports, documents, statements of people who are not present at the murder? Is that an example of confirmation bias when you take into account all of these other reports, documents, statements of people who are not present at the murder?
There you go.
Right. So he's talking about Tammy Daybell.
He was talking about Tammy Daybell, and the prosecution had just crossed, and he was redirecting and trying to prove or trying to imply that Tammy's death might not have been murder. That it might have been natural. That's his defense. And while attempting to say that, look, we don't know that this couldn't have been natural, and the medical examiner's office is wrong with her cause of death, it's not homicide. He literally says, he calls it murder, at the time of murder. He doesn't say time of death. He says, you know, at the time of murder.
But the important point here is he's talking about Tammy, and his whole argument for Tammy has been that she died of natural causes.
Right. And his entire thing. And at this moment, he was trying to convince the jury of that.
So his whole argument,
Is that an example of confirmation bias when you take into account all of these other reports, documents, statements of people who are not present at the murder?
Right. Keep in mind, the important point here is that his whole case regarding Tammy's death was that it was natural causes and not murder. And here you have him calling it a murder.
A quick word from today's sponsor. Did you know that the average dieter will try 162 diets over the course of their lives? Sono Bello is the only way to permanently lose unwanted fat and inches. Sono Bello doctors are masters in micro laser fat removal. Wherever you have stubborn fat, tummy, sides, thighs, arms, it's going away permanently in one visit. You can also ask about their modern techniques to eliminate sagging, loose skin. When it comes to feeling good, I always say do what feels best for you and only you, no one else. And if you've ever thought about or are curious about the personal benefits of Sono Bello, you can schedule a free consultation to learn all about micro laser fat removal. Sono Bello is actually running a special right now. Visit sonobello.com/hiddentruecrime. Sono Bello, BELLO.com/hiddentruecrime to schedule your free consultation. Visit sonobello.com/hiddentruecrime. SONOBELLO.com/hiddentruecrime.
If the cycle of yo-yo dieting is familiar to you, you're not alone. What if you could take a weekly shot to lose weight and keep it off? That's where Row comes in. Row provides access to the most popular weight loss shots on the market. The Row Body Program pairs a weekly shot with lifestyle changes so you can lose weight and keep it off. Row handles it all, even the insurance paperwork. You can sign up online from home with no doctor's visits. The average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. Go to row.co/hidden and you'll pay just $99 for the first month and $145 a month after that. The medication costs are separate. Once again, that's row.co/hidden.
A quick word from our sponsor. During Chad Daybell's trial, many continue to ask where I shop. So I am finally coming clean with my wardrobe hack. I rent most of the clothes I wear. Armoire has allowed me to avoid expensive luggage fees as I've traveled back and forth to Boise for Chad's trial. And with a clothing rental membership from Armoire, you build the perfect wardrobe with high quality brands just for you. You take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your personalized closet delivered straight to your door. in as little as 2 days. And then when you're ready for new clothes and ready for someone else to do your laundry, you just swap them out for fresh styles. Armoire has allowed me to branch out and try new styles out of my comfort zone. And I love shopping for new clothes every month. So renting from Armoire is a win-win. And then I send it back for more. Right now, our gems can give Armoire a try to get up to 50% off their first month. That's up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/hiddentruecrime. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/hiddentruecrime to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today.
You asked me if I thought that would be important. And I guess my first response was, I don't know, because I don't, you know, it depends on what the jury heard. You know, moments like that, I think it's been a long trial. The jury's been sitting there for a long time. I don't know if they're hanging on every word. People like us that are reporting on it and are curious about putting this puzzle together, I think we have the time to kind of go back and reflect on these types of moments, but I'm not sure the jury does. And so the question, you know, do I think it's important? Yes. But do I know if the jury heard that and is going to make sense of it and process it in a way that could affect the case? I don't know. Like, if I had to bet, it seems to me like these types of moments kind of slip through the cracks and that maybe they're not going to catch that. But let's say for the sake of argument, they do catch that. You know, I'm a psychologist, so my job is to process the psychological elements of this case. And let's talk about why that could be important. Number one, what is a Freudian slip? Basically, Freud believed that slips of words or the tongue or these types of things were similar to dreams in the sense that Freud saw dreams as the mind was in a state of vulnerability in sleep. And that so the typical ego defenses are not operating. That means that the mind is freer to kind of free associate and make connections between things. And so dreams, according to Freud called dreams the royal road to the unconscious. And what he meant was that dreams reflect all those things that we kind of push away during the day, all those things that are kind of forbidden, the things we try to repress. And at night, they're given more free rein because we're not guarding them as much. Our egos are not as involved in keeping things quiet in our mind at night. In fact, we can't. And so Freud saw slips like this as being similar. These are the moments when those unconscious impulses or desires kind of break through the ego's defenses and they expose what the individual is really thinking or feeling. And so what's fascinating about this, if we go with that theory of a Freudian slip, what's fascinating about this is the prior thinks this was murder. What you have here, I think you've got a defense attorney at the end of a very long trial. There's a lot of stress. There's a lot of cognitive overload, meaning he's trying to process a ton of stuff. There's anxiety here, right? There's distraction. There's all this stuff. He's been defending again. Let's just say hypothetically, he believes this is murder. Deep down, he believes this is murder. But he knows, obviously, he can't say that or he can't show that. He can't even think it. So in a way, he has to repress that. It has to be, it's sort of an unacceptable view or impulse that would obviously cost him his job and cost him a lot. It would cost him, if he said that publicly, it would cost Chad Daybell potentially his life, right? But so you have this situation where you've got all this stress and all this distraction and overload, and here he says it. And I think the reason he's saying it here is because this belief is breaking through kind of those defenses that he's held in check for you know, I don't know how long, like over a month, right? And maybe it's from a psychological standpoint, the way to see this is that Pryor himself at some level thinks that this was murder or he believes this was murder, but he knows that his job obviously is to argue that it's not murder. It's natural because his job is to defend his client. And clearly that's what he's been trying to do for 29 days. This slip might be the most honest moment for Pryor. And by the way, yeah. Pryor would vehemently deny what I'm saying. I'm sure he has to, of course, but he would just say it was a simple mistake. But in a way, that's what's interesting here is that Freudian slips they can be simple mistakes. They can be simple mental errors. They can be deeper than that. They can be deeply repressed material. They can be as dramatic as deeply repressed traumas from childhood, or they could be as simple as being distracted and making a simple mental mistake. Either way, it's still exposing something truthful about the unconscious and what someone really thinks below all those ego defenses. It's really kind of exposing what someone might really think and feel. And I think you had that type of moment here. But you asked me, is this going to matter? It all depends on whether the jury picks up on it. So if the jury heard that and they noted it and somebody wrote it down and they're like, oh my gosh, Pryor just called this a murder. He's been arguing now for 6 weeks that Tammy Daybell was killed, not killed, that Tammy Daybell died of natural causes. And here we go. He just said it was a murder. He's telling us the truth, right? If a juror hears that and notes that, and I don't know, it'll be, you know, after we get a verdict here, I'd like to know. I'd love to ask a juror, did you guys hear that? Did you deliberate on that? When you initially posed that question to me, my response was based on the fact that I said, I don't know if that's going to be important because it's the kind of thing after a long trial that may just slip through the jury, you know, the cracks of the jury being able to process that or hear it or understand it. But if one of them caught it, then it could have monumental importance. If you combine Pryor saying murder for Tammy with the fact that this expert, Dr. Bartolink, is painting this really gruesome picture of how Tylee was murdered and how no matter where she is, that somehow Chad Daybell knew about this and participated in it. I just don't know. I don't know how you get, like, that is not the way to conclude a case, clearly. That this is a complete disaster if those are both accurate. So yeah, I think that those were monumental mistakes or potentially monumental mistakes. But again, I'll be super curious to see what the jury does with that. You know, does that after the fact, after a verdict, you know, maybe we'll be fortunate enough to talk to a few jurors and ask about deliberations and ask about that moment and whether that moment mattered to them. Because, I mean, potentially, yeah, it could be huge. I do think it's a Freudian slip of sorts. By the way, Freud called that parapraxis. That was his technical term for a Freudian slip, parapraxis. If you look at Pryor's body language, there's certainly moments where he's turned his back to Chad. There's moments when he appears disgusted by Chad. Like there's a lot of evidence in Pryor's body language and how he's treating Chad that he probably believes that.
Right.
That he probably believes deep down that Chad did commit murder or may have committed murder. And of course, since he's paid not to argue that or believe it, he's going to act completely differently. But I mean, if you look at him sitting next to Chad day in and day out, there's moments when he's quite collegial with Chad and quite, you know, friendly, but there's also moments when he's not. And you might say, well, that's part of any relationship. Well, maybe, but I mean, he's being paid to act as if Chad is completely innocent. His nonverbal should reflect that. And they don't always do that. And so that's the whole point of a Freudian slip is it really betrays, gets below the surface. It portrays what we're really thinking and it betrays us in terms of how we're trying to act or how we're trying to stay guarded to not let something, not to not reveal our true beliefs.
So what I personally think is a parapraxis is what Emma Daybell said. And I want to say that I did catch this one in the gallery. So this one I caught in the gallery. I don't even think I was like, you know, catching things in the gallery, like you're not paying attention to any one particular thing. And when Emma Daybell stated something about her dad seeing her mother's death, I jumped and it was, whoa. And I can tell you that other people heard it too. And she's a witness, not an attorney.
Yeah.
A lot of people heard it. As we went out for recess, we all, did you hear that? Did you hear that? Yes, other people heard it. And I'd like to play that really quickly.
At the time of the discovery of the passing of your mother, how would you describe your father's emotions?
He was more distressed than I've ever seen him in my entire life. I'm used to, well, at that time I was an adult, but he felt like an adultier adult. I was used to my parents being in control and in charge, and seeing him so distressed and emotionally out of control was very scary to me. And I didn't doubt his grief at all. I'd never seen him more upset than in that moment.
Would you be able to assess whether that was genuine grief or not?
It appeared to be genuine grief.
Is there any doubt in your mind?
No doubt at all.
Okay. You understand that at the time he was involved in an affair with another woman, correct?
Correct.
But in spite of that, you still felt that he was genuinely grieved about your mother's death?
I know that the grief that he felt was real. He may not have had the same romantic relationship with my mother that he had in the past, but I know that he valued her as a person, and seeing her die was very traumatic.
And seeing her die was very traumatic.
Yeah, it's another one of those parapraxic moments, right? It's potentially Emma Daybell telling us that she knows more than she's letting on. It's one of those moments. Maybe she's experienced a lot of anxiety on the stand. She's trying to keep her story straight, and this is a slip. This is her knowledge, or kind of breaking through those defenses and kind of revealing itself. And so again, the question is, will the jury pick up on that? Will they see that? I don't know. That's always the question. If you take it literally, and Emma Daybell is very literal, then she's essentially saying that her dad told her that he was present when Tammy died, which would put him at the scene when she died, when she was murdered.
And that was a moment that Minnie heard in court.
Do you think the jury picked up on that?
Yes, I'm sure someone in the jury heard, because I heard and other people in the gallery heard. And so if you just take the probability there, I assume a juror heard that. And now that I think that going back to Thursday, which we need to process, seeing that the jury is also seeing that Emma Daybell Murray and Garth Daybell are not telling the full truth, they're going to be more inclined to think that Freudian slip was something real.
Yeah. Why don't we go to the prosecution's rebuttal case and talk about their first witness who stated that her bombshell was that Emma told her. So this was a teacher, Miss Jensen, that worked with Emma, and she told Emma that her mother died from a blood clot.
Lisa Marie Jensen, a wonderful woman I was able to talk to after court a bit and thank her for her testimony. And so Lisa Marie Jensen was the first witness that the prosecution called rebuttal, and she was able to testify of Tammy's warmth and how she had many friends at work. She was able to testify of her health and her Fitbit steps. And she was able to testify that Emma Daybell, who she referred to as a friend of hers in court, told her at work, because they all worked together at the same elementary school, that they guessed or assumed that maybe her mother passed away because of a blood clot, which is very different than everything else that had been said.
Right. And so that became extremely important, because Detective Mattingly testified later that Emma had no desire to, and we learned about this previously, but that Emma had no desire whatsoever to know or see or talk about the results of her mother's autopsy. So clearly, not only was she being misleading about the blood clot, she was being dishonest about that. She was essentially lying about it, but she didn't know how her mother died. So she's fabricating the entire blood clot story to try to, presumably, to try to get people to leave her alone, I assume.
Or I don't even know, to fabricate it, with the pink foam, which she also allegedly shared with people at school. I think she could have guessed a pulmonary embolism, which is a clot in your lung, and maybe that was also suggested. But she had told everyone at the school that there was pink foam that morning. So that would be another reason to perhaps share that.
It's important for a lot of reasons. One is it really challenges her credibility, obviously, and that's clearly what the prosecution's up to. But there's a real avoidance here in terms of wanting to know the truth or wanting to know what really happened, right? That this is clearly a case of pretty significant denial, that she doesn't want to know. And I think that's really damning for her, because it suggests that she's going to believe or espouse anything that her father tells her.
Yeah, yeah.
She's going to defend her father no matter what, to the ends of the earth. In fact, you found a blog post that we confirmed was her that essentially says that many years ago, right? What was the date on that? Like 2015?
Yeah. In fact, I'll read it. In fact, a thank you to our gem Kaya for sending this blog post. I thought I had read everything, and we did find Emma Daybell's blog on the Wayback Machine. And we had read a lot of it already, but this was a blog post that we looked into and we did confirm it was hers from 2015 that she wrote about her father. And we have heard from people that she was very close to her father. Dawson Murray, the brother-in-law of Emma, shared that Emma was very, very close to her father, that Garth Dabo was closer to his mother. And she says as much here. So I will just read it. This is copied directly from a blog entry written by Emma Daybell on January 8th, 2015. It's titled Our Heavenly Father, in quotes. One thing that has helped me to better understand my Heavenly Father's love for me is to observe my earthly father's love. I have always been a daddy girl. I would do anything for my dad, and he would do anything for me. My dad has been to multiple David Archuleta concerts. I know that standing in the middle of a bunch of teenage girls screaming at the top of their lungs wasn't something he particularly wanted to do, but he gladly came along with me. Dad has also been to the movie theater with me several times to see cinematic classics, such as the Justin Bieber movie in 3D and High School Musical 3, the sing-along edition. Despite the fact that films of this sort aren't exactly his favorite, Dad went along with me because it was something I wanted to do, and he wanted nothing more than for me to be happy. My dad gets up really early in the morning to go to work. I spent a lot of time in high school talking to him and my mother late at night about problems I was facing. I know it was hard for him to sacrifice much-needed sleep to listen to my angst-ridden teenage problems, but he stayed awake because he loves me and he knew I needed him. My dad knew that losing a student council election was far from the end of the world, but he sat and listened because he knew it was important to me. I knew I could always count on dad for help. When I was serving a mission 14,000 miles away from home, I looked forward to the weekly emails from dad. He understood what was going through and gave timely counsel. When I came home early due to illness, it was while talking with him that I realized I needed to stay home. I love him, and I feel incredibly blessed to have him in my life. Sometimes due to various circumstances, our fathers aren't always there for us the way we would like them to be, but our Heavenly Father will always be there for us. He is the ultimate parent, and he is perfect. He will constantly be there for us. There's quite a few things. I even noticed some new things reading that the second time. But thoughts, John?
I think it confirms everything we just said, that she's in denial. She's very close to her father. She's obviously so close to him, she's willing to go as far as potentially being dishonest to keep him out of prison and to tell his story, even if it's a false story. And even if it means being dishonest about her mother's death, her mother's murder. So, right. But I mean, this issue about she said it all. She said, I'd do anything for my father, including lie about a murder he committed.
That's the first thing she says. I've always been a daddy's girl, clearly. I would do anything for my dad, and he would do anything for me.
Right.
I also calls her, she calls him a dad, her dad, and she refers to her mom as mother. And then she says that her dad wakes up really early, and yet her mother does too. And they both stay up and listen to her, but she's only thanking her dad. Like, she's just very focused on her dad. I apologize though. But yes, she would do anything for her dad, and he would do anything for her.
Right. And she is. And she's even going so far as to stick her head in the ground and pretend that her mother wasn't murdered. And she seems fine with that. So I think Emma Daybell is showing that to a large extent, she's incapable of processing reality. And I said this before earlier in the week, her inability, her desire not to see the autopsy results, not to process them or understand them, shows that she's in total denial and that she's avoiding the truth. She's avoiding what really happened here. She doesn't want to know. And presumably, even if she knows, she's still going to be in denial about it and believe her father.
Those autopsy results, that was something else that happened in court on Thursday, part of the prosecution's rebuttal. Oh, there were three witnesses, right? And this was a law enforcement officer who tried to show Emma Daybell her mother's autopsy results before the public knew, wanted to sit down with her, no strings attached, no interview, gave her a victim's advocate at that same time. And she said, I don't want to see the autopsy results. I don't want to know them. I mean, really, she's saying, I don't want to know them. What you said was interesting, though. You said you realized that she has no ability to process reality. What do you mean by that? Because it's true. That's what I'm seeing, but that's what people can't fathom or have a hard time understanding.
Again, not having any desire to know how her mother died, not wanting to know, not having the desire to share the, you know, to go over the autopsy results with the detective. Her belief system is comparable or similar to her father's. So I think that probably, because it's potentially so extreme, that probably compromises her ability to really process the world effectively and realistically. So I think those all run together. So it goes beyond the autopsy results. So what I mean is that, taken as a whole, her belief system, her relationship with her father, her extremely close relationship with her father, her inability to really want to see, her desire not to see the autopsy results, all of that, I think, really impairs her ability to effectively make sense of the world.
Someone is wondering if Chad had the ability to turn his daughter then against his wife, against her own mother, Tammy Daybell.
I think that was happening years ago. I don't know if I'd use the term turn against. I think it was probably more a case where Chad was becoming more emotionally attuned and closer to Emma. And then in some ways, I think Emma was becoming more of a spouse than Tammy. That Emma was probably a bit of a surrogate spouse for Chad, and that Chad probably felt more emotional closeness to Emma than he did to Tammy. And so I think that division was probably happening for a long time.
Yeah. Agree. That makes sense. Thank you for explaining that.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.